This is Joanna Kearns, and you're listening to Fascination Street Podcast.
I believe that everybody has a story, and I'm fascinated to hear them. So come with me as we take a walk down Fascination Street. Welcome back, Streetwalkers. This episode is with actor, writer, director, political cartoonist, Jonathan Schmock. Jonathan has written for almost every show you watched as a kid. He did stand-up back in the olden days. He was actually even on The Tonight Show with Johnny Carson twice, and when it rolled over to The Tonight Show with Jay Leno, him and his partner got banned for life from that show. So that's a really cool story. We talk about stuff like that. We talk about some of his acting career, including Shameless, that Showtime television American version show that he was on. And of course, we talk about what everybody knows him from, the snooty, snotty Mater D from Ferris Bueller's Day Off. We have a good time. Jonathan's a great dude. He tells great and fascinating stories. You're really, really going to enjoy this, I promise. And this is my conversation with writer, actor, director, and mensch, Jonathan Schmock. Yeah, talk to me, yeah. Welcome to Fascination Street Podcast, Jonathan Schmock. How you doing today, man?
I'm really good. How you doing, Steve?
I am fan-freaking-tastic. Ladies and gentlemen, this is Jonathan Schmock. You know his face. You might not know his name, but I promise if you're over, I don't know, 10 and under 80, you know this dude. I promise. Okay. So we're going to talk about all things Jonathan Schmock. First of all, where were you born and raised, man? Where'd you grow up?
I grew up in San Diego, California. I'm a California boy. I grew up in a little community called La Jolla and went to La Jolla High. That was my life. And then I went to New York City and I was like, where's the beach?
Where's the beach? Before you went to New York, what did you want to be when you grew up? Like, what was your plan?
My plan was to be an actor.
From when?
Since the very beginning. I remember my parents took me to this thing and there was a guy who did this poem, Casey at the Bat. And I saw him afterwards, like in front. It was like a show for kids. And he had on like a costume and makeup. And it was just like, man, this is so cool. And I just was always, as a kid, I was doing little skits and trying to be funny. And I was just hooked from the very beginning. I just wanted to do it. And it was like, well, I'm going to be an actor. And it sort of never went away because it's a slippery slope. Because then it's like in junior high, you can do that. And in high school, you can do that. And then it's, you know, if your parents are foolish enough to let you persist, you can persist. And I did. But I mean, I was interested in other things. But, you know, in high school and all your friends are like, oh, what am I going to do? Where am I going to go to school? Oh, I don't have any interests, man. You know, and it was like, well, Jonathan, you're going to be an actor, right? And I'm like, yeah, that's what I'm going to do.
So your parents were pretty supportive of that?
They were, strangely. Yeah. I lost my dad when I was pretty young, but my mom still was. She was very supportive of the arts. And she was, you know, one of the original California hippies. And she was, despite all the odds of how crazy it was. And then at one point, after I was doing it for a while, I said, this is too lonely. I wanted to be in a phone call coming in business and not a phone call going out business where I wasn't constantly like, give me a job, give me a job. So I said, hey, Mom, I want to go back to school and I want to go to medical school and I want to be a doctor. And she said, okay. And she was totally mom supportive of that. And I went back to school for about 2 years. I went to Columbia, where the big boys go. And I realized, wow, there are people who are naturally good at math the way I'm naturally good at being funny. And I am not one of those math people. I learned that very quickly. I went into a calculus class because you got to know all this math to be a doctor. I did not know what this woman was talking about from day one. And that was exemplified on the final exam. And a Shakespeare festival came up and I took it and I never looked back. And I always thought if I had two lives to live, I would be the funny doctor in the other one, or an architect or something like that.
The funny architect.
The funny architect. Your building has no roof. Yeah.
Okay. So you went to New York, you said, was it so that you could go to school?
Yeah. I went to NYU.
Tish?
No, it's actually even worse. I got a college degree in acting from, I guess technically it was Tisch, but it was the drama department. It wasn't even the acting department. So there was a lot of, you know, some kind of book study involved. But it was the only place where you could study at the New York Professional Studios. And I studied with Stella Adler for 4 years. And there was Lee Strasberg and HB and I get the experimental theater wing. So like at 18, I was studying with Stella Adler.
What was that like?
Oh, my God. It was very intense. Stella was amazing. I loved her. She was very tall and very dramatic and very old. And she sat on a throne, literally. It was from a set.
Sure.
It was a red velvet throne. She did not know what to make of us because she was used to working with seasoned New York, young Marlon Brando and people like that. And we were like high school students who didn't have a clue. She would just, "You're small, darlings, you're small, you must be big. The theater is big." I mean, you know, she took a lighter and tried to light this girl on fire. It's true. "You're dead. Look, I'm going to light you on fire. Why don't you react?" And she chased her. I mean, she's in her 70s and she's chasing Melanie. I still remember it. Chasing her around the room with a lighter, trying to light her on fire. She was fantastic, though.
Oh, my God. That's hilarious. I'm pretty sure that two-time previous guest Ed Asner worked a lot with Stella Adler when they were both not dead.
Yes. Ed Asner. God bless him. I worked with Ed Asner once, and he was the most amazing guy. He was fantastic. I saw him once, I think, at an awards show or something, and he remembered me, and he was just the greatest guy. He had the greatest sense of humor. And I was directing. It was on an episode of Dharma and Greg. He was a guest star. And said, "Hey, Ed, Jonathan, director, I've always loved your work." And he looks at me and he goes, "So why haven't you hired me before?"
That sounds like Ed.
He would do like the rehearsals, and he was just an amazing actor. And then it was time to shoot the show. It was before a live audience. And he turned on a level that was so much above. I mean, it was like he was amazing in the rehearsals. And it's just like some people have this gear. And, you know, he didn't want to waste it on rehearsal. But when it was on, he just went to this place that was just amazing.
That's amazing. I hear that a lot about the previous generation of actors. Like Walter Matthau. I think it was Walter Matthau.
Jack Lemmon.
Thank you. There you go. Jack Lemmon is the answer I was looking for. Legend has it that right before they said action, he would say, "It's magic time," and then light up like somebody turned an on switch, and then he would, you know, kill it.
Yeah, I've seen it happen.
Okay, so you're back in New York and you're going to acting school and you have a degree in drama. Then what's the next step? Are you doing theater? Are you doing Black Box? Are you doing commercials? Law and Order? What are you doing?
Never been on Law and Order. I've always wanted to.
Weird.
I was lucky enough to go to school with a guy named Jim Valley. And we were both Schmock and V Valley, because there was the A to M group and there was the M to Z group. And we were in the same group. I was all serious and, you know, into the drama. And he was the funniest guy I've ever met. Since the first, I remember I wrote a letter, that's how long ago, on paper, I wrote a letter to my mom. And I said, "I met the funniest guy ever today, this guy, Jimmy. And we teamed up, we became fast friends, and we teamed up because when you're an actor, everybody, agents are, you know, they're always saying, "Well, if you're in something, let me know and I'll come and see you."
Right.
And Jimmy figured out if we did stand-up comedy, we could be in something any time. So we'd say, "Hey, you want to see us? We're going to be at this comedy club this week and these times next week." And so we started to do stand-up comedy together. And we were a comedy team, Schmock and Valerie. Later, we went on and became the Funny Boys because nobody could spell Schmock and Valerie. And we wanted the most generic name possible that was kind of just odd, you know. And so we chose the Funny Boys. Hopefully, someday we'll be the Funny Men. Mm-hmm. And we started to do stand-up comedy. And it was just at the beginning of that comedy sort of boom. And we worked at Catch a Rising Star mostly, because every comic has their home club. And Catch was our club, the Comic Strip, the Comedy Cellar downtown, Sweeps. And we did that.
So when you are doing comedy, you and Jim, like, there's not too many comedy duos. You know, you got the Schmuckers Brothers and the Sklar Brothers. How was it double teaming stand-up? Like, how did that work?
It worked good because we would fit into any bill. A team can go anywhere. And, you know, the bad news is you got a headline. You got to be really good. And the other bad news is if they're flying you someplace, it's two airfares and it's two hotel rooms. But the good news is you don't conflict. I mean, the teams back then, there was Overton and Sullivan. They were a team a little bit before our time. And there was Mac and Jamie, who was another team. You never work with them, but you can be booked anywhere because it sort of breaks up because we're different. A team is different.
So you and Jim are still friends to this day.
Oh, we're best friends.
Very, very good. Oh, best friends. Oh, good job.
I was at his house yesterday.
Really?
Yep.
Rad.
Thank you, Tom. It is always nice. It's always nice when we have comedians, especially new comedians who have not appeared nationally before, to come out and have an audience like we have tonight, because it helps them. There are two young fellows who got started at a place called Catch a Rising Star in New York. They work frequently at the Improvisation in Hollywood. Their names are Jonathan Schmuck and Jim Vallely, and they bill themselves as the Funny Boys. Here they are.
Now, a birdie told me that as a team, you two were on The Tonight Show with Johnny Carson twice. And then when Jay took over, you guys got banned for life?
Yes, apparently so.
What happened? Do I got to call Jay?
No, he was as surprised as we were. So we'd done it twice with Johnny Carson, which was good. And then Johnny said he was going to leave, and all the comics were sad because being on The Tonight Show with Johnny was a big deal. It was a rite of passage. And Jay had just taken over the show, and the producer, The Tonight Show producer, was staying on to sort of get Jay started. And this guy, Jim McCauley, was the talent booker, and he was always bugging me and Jimmy to get another set for The Tonight Show. And sort of the big bit, the last bit that we came up with while we were working was based on the premise. And let me preface this by saying, I love Elvis Presley. I'm a huge Elvis Presley fan. I think he's amazing. And I love this movie, Elvis, the Baz Luhrmann movie. Thought it was amazing. But back then, we thought it was so crazy that people would not accept the fact that Elvis had died. He was dead, and there were these sightings, and they saw Elvis and all these Elvis impersonators. So we thought it would be funny if, since he was dead, to do a good impersonation of Elvis, the guy had to be dead who was doing the impersonation. So we did sort of a Weekend at Bernie's sketch of dead Elvis, and I was Elvis, and I was dead. And Jimmy was like the manager who had kind of like poles and sort of controlling my arms and legs. We did it at the Improv in Los Angeles. And Jay was there. And Jim McCauley was there, his talent booker. And also Bob Morton, who booked Letterman, was there that night too. And Jim McCauley was like, oh, that's not right for The Tonight Show. And Bob Morton said, oh, well, I want him. We didn't hear this for years. And Bob said, well, I'll take him because I want him to do it on Letterman. And then Jay kind of said, oh, no. I want it on The Tonight Show. And so then McCauley was like, yeah, we want it on The Tonight Show. And so we're going to do it on The Tonight Show. And it was crazy to do because that stage is really small. The rake of the audience is really steep. Johnny or Jay is right there. And that band is amazing. And it's like 10 feet away. And I'm in an Elvis outfit with a wig and dark glasses and strapped up like I'm a Waylon Flowers and Madam or whatever. It was the only time that we weren't super nervous because there's no way out of this. You know, you can't bail on this bit. And Jimmy pulls me out and turns me around and there's this gasp. Then the music, you know, ba-da-ba, ba-da-ba. And we do this bit and we had planned a whole thing on panel where Jimmy drags me over to the panel with Jay. And so we do the bit and we, even through the music, it's like we're getting laughs and everybody likes it and, you know, applause. He drags me over and Jimmy's like, you know, makes my dead hand shake Jay's hand. And then it goes to commercial and my eyes are closed and I'm not just trying not to breathe heavily. And we hear this voice that says, "Get them off my stage." And so Jimmy's like, "Come on, we got to get, you know, go, go, go." And so we get off the stage and Jay sort of said, "I got to tell you that that was not a dead guy. That was the Funny Boys doing their thing." And it turns out, which we didn't hear until years later, that Elvis and Johnny Carson's producer, whose name I won't mention because was an amazing producer, were very good friends and had worked together. And Elvis had always called him sir, you know, everything. And he didn't know that we were going to do this bit. And so when he saw it, he said, you know, it pissed him off. So then we were banned from the Tonight Show. And we were kind of giving up the act anyways and going on into writing and acting. So it wasn't that big a deal. And then, you know, when I saw the Baz Luhrmann movie, I kind of felt bad because Elvis was an amazing talent. And I think he was kind of an American tragedy. But I mean, you know, we weren't trying to piss anybody off. We were trying to be funny.
Well, I think that is hilarious. And I'm sorry that that happened. But what a great story.
It is a great story. And it shows up. The bit shows up on YouTube and Facebook every now and then.
Love it. I bet your phone rings off the hook.
Yeah, it does. I did the Tonight Show 3 times. We probably wouldn't have done it again. We never did Letterman. I wish we had. But when you can say, yeah, we got banned from the Tonight Show, that's pretty cool.
That is pretty cool.
Right?
But I think that's amazing.
Hey, Streetwalkers. Here's a word from our sponsors.
In times of trouble, what do you do? Do you face it alone? Or do you find the best help that you can? When it comes to justice, our lawyers are experts in civil, criminal, and family matters. At Phillips & Hunt, we are committed to you and committed to justice.
Give us a call at 1-800-LITIGATE. That's 800-548-4428.
Or visit us at floridajustice.com.
Let's get back into it.
So you guys, I guess, transitioned into writing and acting. Why writing?
Jimmy always wanted to be a writer. He is the funniest person I know, and he was never comfortable being a performer, as comfortable as I am. I'm a ham, and I am to this day. I love it. Give me words to say, and I'll say them. And I'll do a funny voice and I'll put on funny clothes and a mustache. And that's always what I wanted to do. When we came out here, we did a pilot about us. It wasn't about us, but we were the leads in a pilot. And then from that, we went on and we were on a show called Double Trouble with the Seagal twins. They were twin girls, really cute. And we were on the second season with a guy named Don Rio, produced that and wrote it. Don, who I just saw the other day, and the Seagal twins, basically handed Jimmy and I both our career because we were on that as actors. And so I kept going, trying to be an actor. And Jimmy went to Don and said, "I want to be a writer." And Don took him under his wing and started to get him work writing sitcoms, you know, 3-camera comedy. And I was an actor until my accountant said, "John, maybe you should think about being something else since you bought a house." And I said, "Oh, yikes." And I went to Don and I said, "Don, I've noticed that my actor friends are always looking for work and my writer friends are always working." Don took me under his wing and we both, luckily, like we got into the stand-up boom just as it was happening. I mean, it was really a new thing when like Carlin and Pryor and those guys were a little before us. But it was, you know, Reiser and Seinfeld and Bill Maher. And I mean, we auditioned for Catch a Rising Star the day that Bill Maher auditioned. We were like that class. Jimmy like stood online and talking to this guy, Bill. But that boom, we were part of that boom. And then there was a whole multi-camera, what they call sitcoms, boom that happened. We got into that boom too. And we had a blast and we worked at a lot of different places and wrote on a lot of different shows, created shows together. That's why that happened, because it was just, hey, you know, you fall into things and it's like, if it's not terrible, you do them.
You were a writer on Blossom. Was Jim a writer on that as well?
He was not a writer on Blossom, but we worked at a place called Whit Thomas, which was an amazing production studio. And I tell you, young writers, these kids today in their 30s, about those days, which was, I guess, what was it, Steve? The 90s, I guess?
Yeah, Blossom was early 90s.
Yeah, this company, Whit Thomas, a production company, and it was Paul Whit and Tony Thomas. Tony's still around. Paul has died, sadly. They were the greatest guys. And it was the two of them, their secretaries, production manager, Denise, her assistant, and that was the company. And they had like 7 shows on the air.
Wow.
Everybody knew everybody. And it was just this atmosphere. I mean, but it was Empty Nest and Blossom and the Larroquette show and Herman's Head. And I can't even remember all the shows they had, but they would do all these pilots. They'd get a bunch of shows. There was a lot of sort of swapping and you're helping. They need jokes. Go be on the punch up on this show. You go schmuck. They need a guy to play a guy in an army uniform, walks through the bus station. Go and suit up. Just go do that. Yes, sir, chief. You know, so it was great. So I was on Blossom. You know, then I left Blossom and I went on to another show with Rob Lezebnik created called Muscle. And I was there. So it was just sort of this free for all. It was fantastic.
So at the beginning of that, you said that you were like, yikes, my acting isn't really paying all of the bills. Did writing do that for you? It sounds like you were just crazy busy.
Yes, I was. I was just crazy busy. Jimmy always was happy where he was, which is an amazing talent to have. He was very happy when he was doing stand-up. He was very happy when he was an actor. He really wanted to be a writer. He was very happy as a writer and, you know, amazing and successful to this day. I always wanted to sort of do something else. I still wanted to be more of an actor. But then when I was writing, I wanted to direct, and I eventually got into directing, and I got to direct some, which was, I think, where I would have been the most happiest, because I could have been the most pretentious as a director, which is, you know, certainly I have no problem being pretentious. But I did get to do some directing, like we were talking about with Ed Asner, and that was good. But yeah, it did pay the bills. I've been very lucky and smart enough not to throw it all away. So,
do you still write?
I consult.
Okay.
Do I sit down in a cabin with a pipe? No, but
I don't know if you're aware, but the pipe is optional. You don't have to use the pipe.
I mean, people think about television writing and they think that it's like you go away, but it's mostly sort of a collaboration in a room with a lot of guys. And, you know, you sort of bang out a story. I mean, it's funny because people think of writing as being so solitary. And the years that I've spent writing on television, the thing that's been sort of taxing on me is how gregarious it is, because you are in a room with 16 other people for 10 hours a day, 11 hours, 12 hours a day. It's very social, you know, except for a pilot. And that's really the hard work when you're pitching a pilot, breaking a story. It's like breaking rocks by yourself. That's really hard work. But the fun part is just going through the script and pitching and throwing things in, and that back and forth between funny, creative people. I mean, there's nothing like it.
You have some connection to Sabrina the Teenage Witch. Did you create it? Were you a writer on it? What's your connection with Sabrina?
Joey Lawrence, who was on Blossom, wanted to do a show with his two real life brothers. And Jimmy and I went in together and pitched a show along with a lot of other people. And we got it. And we did that show.
That was Brotherly Love, right?
Yeah. And we had a great, I did a lot of directing of those episodes. We had a great time doing that. We did it for one season on NBC and then it got canceled. My agent at that point had decided that I was a kid show guy. I don't know why. I didn't have any kids, and said, hey, Paula Hart, who's Melissa Joan Hart's mom, was very smart, and she got the rights to Sabrina the Teenage Witch, which was a comic book that was sort of in the with Archie and Jughead. And she wanted to do a series with her daughter, you know, Sabrina the Teenage Witch. And I went and met with them. I had to fly through like a tornado to the East Coast. And I pitched them what I thought. And they, for some reason, liked me. So I got that. I pitched this series. We got it picked up at ABC. I wrote the pilot. Then there were these drums were signaling that another network, the WB, I think, was going to pick up Brotherly Love. And contractually, I had to go back to Brotherly Love. And I had to leave. And so the person who I'd hired to be my co-runner of Sabrina took over. So, I mean, you know, I never got to be a part of it. I was in casting when I had to leave. And they took over and the show was a big hit. I'm sure I would have screwed up. So I don't know what I think what the DGA, I mean, I think it's developed by me. I was never there for shooting because I had to leave. So, you know. Like I said, I probably would have screwed it up, but, you know, it was fantastically successful. And Melissa Joan Hart was amazingly talented.
She still is. Why weren't you the voice of the cat?
I would have been the voice of the cat. Nick Bakay, who I know was the voice of the cat, but in my version, I was going to be the voice of the cat. And the cat was going to be an old guy like this, who's like maybe from New York, who'd been around. That's how I was going to do the cat. But like I said, I probably would have screwed up the show. I wanted to have one of the Council of Witches. One of the witches was going to be a live dolphin. I'm just happy it was a big hit because people make fun of kids shows like, oh, it's not important. Kids shows are about firsts. The first kiss, first car, first girlfriend, first job. Those are important moments in your life. And if you take them seriously, they're huge. Remember your first job, how nervous you were, you know, and how you screwed it up and you thought you were going to die?
Yeah.
That's good stuff.
So even though you didn't work on it a whole lot, and obviously I don't want any numbers, but did you get paid for the duration of the series? Like, did you keep getting paid on that show even after you left?
I did.
Oh, fantastic.
I had no contractual agreement for that. I don't remember the studio. Not the network, the studio. I don't like to name a lot of names from the past and all that, but he was such a good guy. He was like, no, John got this on the air. He needs a cut.
Wow.
Yeah. I mean, that's a good show business story.
Yeah.
That was not like, how can we screw these guys out of money? That was like, no, he got this on the air.
Hey, Streetwalkers. Here's a word from our sponsors.
Now, I didn't know how good I had it till I met some other whiskeys from the city. It turns out a small town and an even smaller batch made me the most headstrong spirit both sides of the Pecos. Call me Critical Batch, Texas Bourbon. Raised by a sailor in Bull Verde, Texas, bottled at 110 proof, they took me out of the barrel and didn't know which end to slap. So why don't you come taste the pure definition of bourbon? Grain to barrel to bottle. And join our little rebellion. You may all go to the liquor store. I'll be at Chaplin Distillery, 30790 Blanco Road in Bull Verde, Texas. Ask for CB in the tasting room, and I'll see you soon. That was the bourbon talking, Streetwalkers. Chaplin Distillery is proudly veteran-owned and operated. Follow them on Instagram and Facebook, or go to chaplindistillery.com. And maybe I'll see you at the tasting room.
Let's get back into it.
You're friends with Eddie Gorodetsky?
Oh, my God. Steve, I loved you before. Yes. I saw Eddie on Sunday.
Oh, my gosh. How is he?
Boy, any friend of Eddie Gorodetsky, you have to say two words to me, Eddie Gorodetsky, and, like, I'm on your team.
I've never met him. I don't know him. I've been trying to reach him, but he doesn't seem to be very much on social media. So if all this goes well and you still like me at the end of this, I will ask you one of these days to put me in touch with that guy because that dude is rad. Oh my gosh.
He is. How do you know of Eddie?
I just know that he's either a writer or a consulting writer on almost every show that's ever existed. And I've had a lot of writers on the show and I have some writers who are friends. And to a man or woman, they all say, Eddie Gorodetsky is, quote, the best punch-up guy in the business.
Absolutely. To answer your question, Eddie is A, fine, and B, Eddie is Eddie. He is amazing. I was lucky enough to meet him. One of the other shows that I created, I don't know why, was a show with Aaron Spelling, which is a whole nother story, called The New Love Boat. And my agent said, you have a meeting to go meet with Aaron Spelling about doing The New Love Boat. And I thought he was joking. I thought he was kidding. He was not. And I went in and I met, and I had a take on The New Love Boat, and I pitched it. You know, how are you going to bring The Love Boat back, right? Cesar Romero is no longer with us to be the guest star, you know?
Yeah, and what was her name? Cha-Cha? What was her name?
Charo.
Charo, yeah. She's. I don't think she's going to be doing the show. How do you do it?
The way Spelling does those Dynasty, the way they work is very different than the way the rest of Hollywood works. It's like, if you're at Spelling, you don't leave Spelling, and you don't know how the rest of us cats walk the walk. They said, you can bring one writer with you to do The New Love Boat. And I said, I want Eddie Gorodetsky. And we had the most surreal experience doing The New Love Boat. We lasted a year. We did a full season. And he left. And I got to the you can't fire me, I quit session. But we had a very fun, surreal year. And I got to go out on the ship. And it was insane. I mean, I had my own jet. I was on a jet with the crew and the cast and all the cameras. It was a jet, the LAX, you know, and the jet took off when I said it took off. And then I realized, oh, you have no control over this show at all. They don't think a showrunner is what you think a showrunner is. So we had some problems, but we also had some great times. And Eddie and I had the most fun / miserable time, I think, ever. But Eddie's a great guy. He's just great. I don't spend enough time with him. But in your life, you have a handful of friends who are like, not only are you glad that you know them, you're glad that they know you, because they're such amazing people. The fact that they take an interest in knowing you, that makes me feel good. It's like, wow, Eddie considers me a friend because he's such an amazing guy.
I love that story. I think the most recent time I saw Eddie's name on a show, it was Mayim Bialik's new show, which is called Call Me Cat. I believe he's a consulting producer on that or something. I saw it and I went, holy shit, Eddie Gorodetsky's still working. He's still doing stuff. That's amazing.
Sure.
Obviously, I'm going to ask you about one of the most seminal films of my entire life. You have no way of knowing this, but when I was in, I don't know, sixth or seventh grade, I was seeing a therapist dealing with some family issues, and the therapist told my mom that she had to spend more time with me. And so as soon as the therapist meeting was over one day, she said, what do you want to do? I said, I want to go to the movies and I want to see Ferris Bueller's Day Off. And so basically by prescription, my mom took me to go see that film. And I'm sure everybody who talks to you and runs into you on the street tells you they could quote that movie by heart. I'm one of those idiots. I love that movie. And you specifically, your performance, I quote it all the time just because it's so ridiculous. Like, my name is Steve Owens. And anytime somebody, like a friend or something, uses my full name or family or whatever, if they use my whole name, they'll say, hey, Steve Owens. And I go, I'm Steve Owens, the sausage king of Chicago. And it's so ridiculous. But tell me how you came to be a part of that movie. And also, I heard a rumor that Del Close was in that movie. Was he in that movie?
Yeah, Del is in the movie. I don't remember what he played, but you can look it up. He is in the movie. That's such a great story you told about your mom and your childhood.
Oh, well, thank you. I have a Save Ferris shirt hanging in my closet, but I didn't wear it for this interview because I didn't want to be that guy. How did you come to be a part of that movie?
Jimmy and I are in LA. We're still a team and we're acting and we're doing stand-up and we're trying to write. And our agent somehow hooked us up with this writer-producer named John Hughes. he was working and he had a hot hand and he was writing and directing and producing his own movies, mostly for kids. And we met him and pitched him some things and he liked us and we liked him. This is the story I say, and it wasn't exactly this, but it was like, he said, yeah, I'm screening. I got a copy of Some Like It Hot or something. You know, you come on by. Yeah, Universal at 1, screening room B or whatever. You know, and it was like that kind of vibe. And he was doing a lot of talking about, you know, he wanted to do an adult comedy with two guys, like they were traveling, you know, which may have become later Planes, Trains, and Automobiles. And he just sort of mentioned, he said, hey, yeah, I'm doing this movie about this kid who plays hooky from high school, and there's some parts in it. Go and audition. And me and Jimmy did, and pretty much everyone. And he was seeing a lot of comics to play various parts. I'd never done anything like that, but I got this part of the maitre d', and I was going to do this movie. It was like the first big movie I was ever in. And I remember driving to the location, because the interiors were shot here in LA, and seeing all these giant trucks, these huge, you know, and they've all got, you know, Paramount on this. And I was like, man, what is this for? It was just an amazing experience. It was kind of just the stars were in alignment. The week before, I had a mustache because I guess it was the 80s. And I got a call from the production, you know, like the line producer. He said, yeah, John wants to see your mustache. Can you go to the set at this, you know, other place? And I did. And like, hi, John, Jonathan, hey, thank you for blah, blah, blah. And he's like, looks at me and it's like, yeah, shave the mustache. Is that okay with you? And I was like, absolutely. So I shave the mustache. And then I go to the, you know, the day, you know, when we started shooting, and he comes into the makeup trailer and he said, I made a mistake. Can you get him a mustache? And they were like, yeah, sure. So, you know, we made comedy. We created comedy. And John was without a doubt the best director I've ever worked with. And he was such a fan. He was such a comedy fan. And he would sit like right next to the lens of the camera. So you were really, you were doing it for him. He shot so much footage and he was so at ease and he was so funny. And he would, hey, do this. Let's say this line and riff on this. And like he and I, unfortunately, both smoked at the time. Kids don't smoke. And we would go outside and smoke and like, hey, what do you think? Do you have any ideas? What about this? What about something like this? You were just kind of in, even though he was John Hughes and I was like, you know, this guy, you were collaborating. I mean, that first scene when we come into the restaurant, I did that with a French accent a bunch of times. And then at one point he said, I don't know about that French accent. It's like, I don't want it to be too much like Serge from Beverly Hills Cop. What else could we do? And we came up with, well, would it be funny if like a very high and mighty guy had that flat sort of Chicago accent, which I really didn't study. And it was like, yeah, do that. There was just a lot of stuff that he said, improvise, throw in a line. And he was just so giving. And it just seemed like a lot of us, Edie McClurg and me and so many of the people on the cast were just right. We just nailed it. But fortunately, we knew it was going to be funny. We knew it was going to be good. It wasn't hokey, but we did not know then that it was going to be whatever it became. And like you said, I mean, I've had people come up to me and say, I had a terrible experience in high school. I was bullied. I hated it. And I imagined that I went to the high school that Ferris Bueller went to in my mind. And that got me through. And it's just like, so amazing. And I'm just so grateful that I could have been a part of that. Because, you know, you work your whole career. And that was a couple of weeks, 36 years ago.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, and it was just fantastic.
John Hughes movies, for some reason, are eminently quotable. Like all of them. They're just quotable for, you know, an entire generation or more. Your role as Kenwood, I understand that you guys shot like a whole lot of scenes with you, right? There was a whole lot more than made the film. Have you ever gotten to see any of that other footage?
No.
Or did it make any sort of director's cut or anything?
I'm always surprised. John did a very good, you know, that thing when the director talks over the movie. He did that and I did see that. But no, I know that footage exists and I've always been surprised that they didn't put that together as a secondary because he really did shoot a lot. you know, the valet car parkers?
Yeah, they're making a spinoff of those dudes.
They're really?
Yeah, they are. It's called Sam and Victor's Day Off.
Fantastic.
It's going to be made by the same dudes that created Cobra Kai.
Interesting, because in Ferris, they shot a whole sort of a B story with those two guys. And every place that the three of them, Ferris and Cameron, who did Mia Sara? I can't remember her character name.
Her name was Sloane.
John shot a whole nother story of every place the three of them went. The ball game, the art museum. The valet car parkers had a whole story that they were there too. You know, they'd sort of pass each other and not see each other. And one of them, you know, told this story. We were at like this reunion thing in Chicago, and he told this story. It's like, you know, the night of the premiere, John came up to him and said, "Hey, I got good news and I got bad news. Good news is you made it in the movie. Bad news is I had to cut out your whole story." So, yeah, I mean, every now and then there's like they did, which they didn't do as much back then, sort of behind the scenes. And it was like, you know, the shooting of the movie. And that's weird to see. Over the years, I've seen a couple of those things. It's just like, I'm talking to John, or you're in makeup, or, you know, blah, blah, blah. And like, that's weird to see, because it's so long ago, Steve. It's like my memory of it. It's not in black and white, but it's like it was yesterday. But on the other hand, it was like it was a long time ago. But I'm always surprised that they have not put together some of that footage, because, yeah, we shot a lot of it. And I'm sure it still exists.
Maybe some of it will make it into this new spinoff with Sam and Victor. Are both of those actors even still alive?
No, sadly. I saw Larry Flash. I can't remember his last name. And sadly, he died recently, very unexpectedly. But the other guy is still alive. And he lives, I think he lives back east.
Thank you for that. Again, I can never express to you how much gratitude I have for that movie and your role in it. And I mean, it's one of the building blocks that turned me into who I am. And I know that sounds ridiculous, but I promise it's true.
No, listen, that sounds great. And it's one of the things that makes me glad I did what I did, and I didn't become a doctor, because you try to do things for a reason. And if being in show business, there's any reason to it at all, it's just that. So thank you.
You're welcome.
Hey, Streetwalkers, here's a word from our sponsors.
If you'd like to help find answers for the families of unsolved crime victims from all over, or perhaps identify a Jane or John Doe, please visit DNASolves.com, where you can submit your DNA from a consumer testing company like Ancestry or 23andMe to their database. DNASolves.com.
Let's get back into it.
Now I'm going to ask you about the most uncomfortable thing I've ever seen you in.
Oh, great.
You did a few episodes of the Showtime television series called Shameless. And my wife and I are watching that currently. And I think it was season 5. There was an episode called like To My Only Daughter or something like that. And in it, you play the son, the, I guess, gay son of this super asshole old bartender who died, and they were reading his will. And you just had to sit there while they read about your character some of the most heinous and ridiculous and offensive shit I've ever heard on a television program. What was that day like, and how did you not laugh your ass off like for the whole time?
I love that show. I love being on it. The director of that episode was fantastic. Sometimes you really you do an audition and it's like, whoa, that I was really good. And that was one of the times. And the audition was better I didn't hit it in the show the way I did in the audition. This is the thing. That show would do things that you read it and it's like, you can't do that. You can't have the kid break his knee with a hand. And it's like, yeah, you know, they're doing it. They're doing it. And I just thought it was very poignant, that bigotry. Here's a gay man whose own father treats him in this sort of twisted, weird, you know, to be feminized is this insane insult. It was just a very interesting. And also the fact, because I thought, oh, well, they'll want me to be very effeminate. And it was like, no, we want you to just be a guy. It was just a guy. It was just a normal guy.
Yeah.
It was very interesting to play. And the cast was great. And that set, remember that set was amazing. And, you know, because I take at the end, I got the ashes. Yeah. It's urn ashes. And they were in this thing. And it was like real. And I've had to do that, but not that, but I've had ashes in an urn of like my dad. And, you know, I smash them on the floor. And it was very powerful to do. And just because like the dust comes up, it was great. And it's like, you don't want to do a lot of takes.
Yeah, when that happened, I was like, holy shit, I hope that was the first take.
Oh, if it was the first take. I think we did it more than once for protection. You know, sometimes you just do get magic. I mean, once we were, it's on the Love Boat, on the new Love Boat, and Robert Urich played the captain, and there was a basketball court on the top of the ship. We were going to do a bit where he's mad at his son, and he's bouncing the basketball, and he's like mid-court, and like the bit was, he just takes the basketball and throws it over his head, and it goes through the hoop. Nothing but net. And we were like, how are you going to do that? It's like, well, you know, you just throw it up and then we'll cut to and we'll go in close. We'll have a guy on a ladder and we'll do a close up and we'll just drop it through. And he said, great, great. So I said, don't worry about it. You know, first take, just throw it up high. Just throw it up so it goes out of frame. This is great. And we shoot it and he throws it up in the air and it nothing but net from mid-court. And I looked at the camera guy and I said, tell me you got that. And he said, I got it. And I said, cut. That's a wrap.
So that was on you guys were on a wide, I guess, right?
Yeah. We were just did a wide. And it was like he threw it over his head, went through the hoop. And I said, okay, moving on. And Robert Urich was like, I thought you were going to shoot the thing. And I said, you hit it, dude. You scored. And he was like, oh my God. So every now and then you just get a magical shot. And I don't remember on Shameless if we used the first take. It was fun to do though.
I bet. That magic on the first take, I think Vince Gilligan said once that when Walter White threw that pizza and it landed on the roof in Breaking Bad, it just landed right next to the camera, pepperoni side up, first take.
That's so funny. Yeah.
I know we're kind of running out of time here, but I just have one more quick question, and hopefully you'll give me a long answer.
Sure.
When and why did you sort of pivot and start drawing political cartoons? Where did that come from?
I always did. When I was a kid, my mom saved cartoons that I drew when I was 3 years old because she's a mom. She saved them all. I still have some of them. That was my first thing, was drawing and painting and being an artist. And I did go to school for it some and study it. And I studied art criticism. And it was always sort of my first thing that I was always kind of doing, but never really doing. I mean, when I was in New York still, I did decide to do that. And for a year, I tried to be a New Yorker style single panel cartoonist. And always have been sort of doing that. And then with the internet, I mean, back in the oldie days, there were newspapers. You know, there was the Washington Post. And the Washington Post had Herb Bloch. And he was the political cartoonist. And he was there for a lot of years, won a lot of Pulitzer Prizes. And there was a Chicago guy and a New York guy. And there was like the LA Times, it was Paul Conrad, who was the political card, fantastic, won 4 Pulitzer Prizes, you know, for being the and he would go into the office with a suit and tie, and he would work in the office with, you know, pen and ink. And that's the way it worked. And if you weren't one of those guys, you weren't a cartoonist. And then with the internet, it was like, I can be a cartoonist and I can put my stuff out and everybody can see it everywhere. Bad news is you don't get paid, but you can do that.
That was going to be my second question, was, is there any money in that?
No, there's not. I mean, you know, blah, blah. It's like, ask a musician. And like, musicians can do a gig and make money. I mean, nobody wants to come and watch me draw Donald Trump's head. And even more so, because I used to do it, you know, I have a drafting table in a studio that just collects dust. And everything now that I do, it's on the iPad. It's just so easy to do it and boom, and it's out there. It's just good to be expressive and to try to be the first. So the pivot was just, I sort of decided at one point to not do things I didn't want to do, which does not mean do what you want to do. It means don't do what you don't want to do. That was one of the things that I did want to do. I hit it heavily for many, many years. And, you know, I've sort of slacked off because after the what we've just been through, you know, you kind of get burned out. Let's face it, the new guy isn't as funny as the last guy was, you know, in the Oval Office. But I've always done it. So that's the long answer.
Is there a story behind Don't Thwart Me?
Wow. Wow. Where did you hear that? Where did you find that?
If I'm being honest, I found it on your website. I think it's the store. If you go to jonathanschmock.com and you hit the store tab, there's all these products on a website called Society 6, I believe. And there's Don't Thwart Me everywhere. And so since that was the one that was featured, I figured there must be some sort of story behind that.
That image came to me kind of in a dream, drawn that way it's drawn. And I just thought, I have to make a t-shirt of that. Because I want to wear that. And I know my stepdaughter, Natasha, Tosh, and I sort of made it up and, you know, gave it to her for her birthday one year because it's perfect for her. That's what it is. It just came to me. I did one for Claudia, my girlfriend, which is God is mean.
I think you're supposed to say fiance.
Yes, my fiance. I never know. I mean, I do a bit on that. We don't know what to call each other. She is my fiance. We've only been together for 22 years, but we're working on it. I know. When I finally asked her to marry me, she told her stepdad. And he said, really, who's the lucky fella? Yeah. But thank you for noticing Don't Thwart Me. It's my favorite. Folks, get a Don't Thwart Me t-shirt.
Or a coffee cup. All kinds of things. There's Don't Thwart Me everythings.
Society 6 is great. It really is.
You are a legend, and some people, not my people, somebody's people, would say you are a mensch.
Oh.
I hope I'm allowed to use that word, even though I'm not in the tribe, but you are one of the kindest guys I've spoken with. Every interview and interaction that I've heard or seen involving you has been good. Nobody has ever said anything bad about you that I'm aware of. You've never thrown a fit and stomped off anywhere. You've never said anything unkind about anybody in any interview that I've ever heard. And I just want that out there that you're a good dude. You're a class act. You're a great guy, a wonderful interview. Oh my gosh. And as we're going out, can you tell everybody about Claudia and Jonathan Watch Dark?
Wow, Steve. I am such a fan of yours, and thank you for saying I'm a mensch. I mean, I'd rather be a mensch than a legend, because a mensch is tangible. Claudia and Jonathan Watch Dark. Check it out, guys. It's on YouTube. This German show, Dark, there were three seasons of it, is the most serious, convoluted show ever. And we watched it, and we loved it so much. We decided that we had to do a show of us watching this show, commenting on it, because it's so crazy good and so crazily complex in a way that only German people could make it. And we're comedy writers. And we just thought that us talking about the show would be funny. So we made the show and we had fans. And of course, we had a lot of fans. A lot of people thought, you know, you imbeciles, don't you understand the principle of, you know, and they kept saying, you guys, we're not smart people. We're not physicists. We think this is hilarious that these Germans are taking this so seriously. But it's just, everybody should watch Dark because it's amazing. And then you should watch Claudia and Jonathan Watch Dark because it's amazing. It's time travel and they jump back and forth 33 years into the future and the past. And the casting is so amazing because, like, you know, doppelganger is somebody that looks like you, but they cast these people that this guy looks like this guy 30 years in the future. It's just, it blows your mind.
Wow. That sounds insane.
It is.
Jonathan, can you tell everybody where they can find you on social media?
My website is jonathanschmock.com. And I think I'm like Facebook. I'm Jonathan Schmock. I have a public Facebook and a private Facebook. What else is there? Twitter? I'm on Twitter. I'm not much on social media. I should be on Instagram. I am on Instagram, but I forgot how to do it. So there's that.
Jonathan, as we're headed out, is there anything I didn't ask you or we didn't talk about that you specifically wanted to talk about today? Did I miss anything?
No, you do these things. And a lot of times it's the, you know, play your hits, you know, play satisfaction. No, this was great. I had a great time. And you brought up a lot of things that just blew my mind that you even know about. I mean, I guess all I got to say is, hey, America, vote. That's all I got to say.
Yeah, go vote.
Go vote. Come on. Doesn't hurt. Do it.
Jonathan, thank you so much for taking the time out of your busy day and your hectic political cartoon drawing schedule to hang out and let us get to know you a little bit better on Fascination Street. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for asking me, Steve. I mean, the way you said what you did was like, wow, that sounds cool. I want to be on that. He thinks I'm fascinating? Wow. And this has been. It's been fascinating. You are a cool guy, and you obviously do your research. Really, you dug up some cool stuff that I really wanted to talk about, so thank you.
Thank you very much for saying that. I really, really appreciate it. And you, my friend, have a great rest of your week.
Thank you. You too.
You're a badass, dude. Thank you. You are a dream.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Have a great week, man. Thank you so much.
You too.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Opening music is the song Magnolia from the 2001 album Intransigence, used with permission from Douglas Miles Clark. Closing music is from the song Say My Name off the 2021 album Underdog Anthems, used with permission from Jax Hollow. If you like the show, tell a friend, subscribe, and rate and review the show on iTunes and wherever else you download podcasts. Don't forget to subscribe to my YouTube channel. All the episodes are available there as well. Check me out on Vero at Fascination Street Pod and TikTok at Fascination Street Pod. And again, thanks for listening.